Last week, Emmanuel started off this chapter for us. And it's something I noticed, that the first verse of the chapter says that there's a crowd of many thousands gathered. But Jesus wasn't talking to them. He was speaking specifically to his disciples, and that's actually said quite clearly in the early verses. Well, this time it changes. Jesus is now talking to the crowd. One of the points Emmanuel brought out was about hypocrisy, the difference between what we show on the outside and what's going on the inside. And that quite well chimes with some of the stuff we're going to be hearing throughout the Lent course, as far as I can see. In fact, in the first session, they actually quoted a verse that Jonathan read out for us. Right, to get to what we're meant to be doing this week, the passage falls within three parts, to my way of thinking. Oh, I should have said what we speakers have to say. Keep your finger or thumb in the passage that's open on page 1044. The first part is a man's request, and it's rejection. Then there's some straightforward teaching from Jesus on greed. And then there's the story or the parable. I don't want to spend too much time on this man's request. We haven't got any real details of what lies behind it. People can speculate, but it's not terribly worthwhile. Some have suggested, well, maybe the brother hasn't given him his share of the inheritance. Or alternatively, he's had his share, but he wants more. So there's one thing we do know. He wanted something. And the phrase, "I want," echoes all through today's passage. I think this must be the only recorded time when somebody comes to Jesus and asks for help and gets refused. Jesus simply wasn't interested in this. It did not form part of his ministry. And you can imagine, if he had given a ruling, that would immediately have split the audience. Some would have said, yes, 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 well done. Others would have said, no, I don't think he's right on this. And what would they be doing? They'd be talking about this man's request, not on Jesus' ministry. Now, what I want to do now is to cheat a little bit and look at the story. Look at the parable first before we consider the Lord's words. It's entitled, in the scriptures, "The Rich Fool." Well, that's not actually in the original, but it's there for our help. And it only appears in Luke's gospel. You won't find it anywhere else. It takes the form of a parable. Now, I know that because it says so. I can work that out. I've always understood with parables, the idea is to get over one main thrust of teaching, a single point. And it's not a good idea, necessarily, to dig around and concentrate too much on the details. Of course, I may be wrong. We're told on another occasion that parables are intended for the, what you might call, the mass uncommitted audience, to make them think about things. I have a confession. Last month, when I was preparing, I heard that a totally unconnected church had just done this in their sermon. So I thought, I better check online. I might be able to get some deep spiritual insight to give you. Well, in that I failed, in that the speaker's approach was so very different from mine, and there's no criticism intended there. However, there was a quote I felt able to steal from that minister. He was doing his preparation work, and he was discussing the passage with someone who he respected, to get their thoughts on it. And the friend said to him, the problem is the farmer's eyes were too close together. And he looked, what do you mean? I don't understand. Now, okay, a bit of a spoiler. He didn't mean these eyes in the front of your head. He pointed out that the farmer uses the personal pronoun I 6 times within 2 verses. Now, it's a nice quote, but even I had noticed what you might call a certain self-centeredness in the farmer's words. Now, Pam does sometimes accuse me of understatement, with some justification. I have to say, in this parable, there is no understatement. There is exaggeration. Great exaggeration and hyperbole, if you really want to use the word. Now, a farmer's crops vary. You have good years, you have bad years. Most would think themselves fortunate to have enough to make a living and seed corn left over for the following season. In the scriptures, we quite often read of famines and times of scarcity, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. After all, you're fighting sun and rain. It's got to be at the right times. You've got crop disease, you've got pests, fires, you name it, farmers have problems. First thing the Lord said about this farmer, he is rich. Now, that would immediately create a lot of envy in the audience, most of whom would definitely not be rich. But as for our farmer, in the parable, his harvest is totally over the top. Obviously, so much more than he's ever had before. So he decides to give up working, live a life of ease and enjoyment for many years. Usually after a harvest, a farmer has a bit of a celebration, but then he would start to think about his next crop, the ploughing and the sowing, and more work. But not our farmer. He's given all that up. Now, at this point, I think the audience would be really drooling. They would regard our farmer as people today would regard the winner of the national lottery jackpot. And they would be thinking, if only that was me. He would be greatly envied. No more work. Now, just imagine that thought in a society without retirements, without pensions, without social security. Now, this isn't so much as I want, but I've got. And then all those people who would be thinking, this is really lovely, get held up with a jolt. The sentence, the death sentence, this very night your life will be demanded from you. That is a big switch. He isn't described as being a particular sinner. To be rich is normally thought of as being blessed by God. Nor, I would point out, is there any reference to losing his soul or his afterlife. What he loses is his life and the chance to enjoy his possessions. He is self-centered, focused upon himself and focused upon what he's got. He's working and living for himself only. So what's the key message here? You can't take it with you? Well, no, they've known that since the days of the Proverbs of Solomon. God punishes people who are rich? No. the verdict is, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. So we can certainly say that his heart wasn't on God. Now, I'm going to cheat a bit here. I'm going to stop thinking about our rich fool, and I'm going to go to Jesus' teaching about greed. In fact, what Jesus said about greed doesn't even form two sentences. There's just one sentence broken into two statements. The first one, watch out, be on your guard against all forms of greed. Now, that's in the Church Bible. The Authorised Version says, beware of covetousness. In fact, some of the modern versions also say covetousness because I understand, though I don't know Greek, that the same word is used for both greed and covetousness. As covetousness is definitely a sort of greed and a forbidden form of greed, we'd better look at that first. We have to go for the dictionary definitions. To covet is to envy the possession of or long to possess. It's the basic I want. Now, as someone from a free church background, I've noticed in the Church of England churches that I've visited that there are always two panels on the wall. One has got the Lord's Prayer one side, the other one has got the Ten Commandments. Well, I've seen it everywhere except here, strangely enough, beside the point. The Tenth Commandment. You shall not covet your neighbour's house, you shall not covet your neighbour's wife, or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbour. Well, I suppose that last phrase includes my neighbour's car or his brand new mobile phone with artificial intelligence. I've heard it said in the past that some people really want to move this commandment. It's number 10 in the list. And they think, well, we should bung it up a bit to number 6 before you might get to what you call the moral commandments. And they'd say something like, King David coveted another man's wife. Well, that's a sin. And that led to adultery. And that's a sin. And murder. And that's a sin. And it was all followed by punishment. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Right, now, let's assume for a moment that I covet your ox or your donkey. I must assure you at this point, I don't really covet your ox or your donkey, but let's assume that. Now, I could try and steal your donkey or your ox, but maybe I don't steal your ox or your donkey. Now, that may be because I just don't have a good opportunity to do it. Or it may be you've got a good night watchman or some particularly fierce guard dogs. But I don't steal your ox or your donkey. Or alternatively, I may find that I'm not going to steal said animal because I'm sure I'm going to get caught. Because I'm the only known person who steals ox or donkeys in the village, and if anything goes missing, they're going to come and see me. I won't get away with it. But it is still a sin, just as it stands, whether or not I steal that ox or that donkey. It is an internal sin, a sin of the heart. And that what differentiates it from the rest of the Ten Commandments. Now, does a sin in the heart ring a bell? Does it remind us of what the Lord himself said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew? Sins happen in the heart, not just in our deeds. The Lord said, I can commit murder or adultery in my heart without ever putting those sins into action. The next slide, please. Be on your guard. The old word from Proverbs. Above all else, guard your heart, for everything flows from it. Jesus said, out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery. You have the list there on the screen. I think that's all I want to say about covetousness. Assuming that the word the Lord used was greed, we ought to go back and have a look at wider greed. Dictionary definition again. Excessive desire, especially for food or wealth. We always tend to think of food when we think about greed. Food and overeating. Now that's far too narrow. Greed is essentially a desire for more. More money, more stuff, more food, just more. It's that I want again. And Jesus talked about all forms of greed, and it's not just Jesus who says this. The apostles say it too. It's mentioned alongside serious sexual sin in Paul's writings. So maybe we just don't take it seriously enough. Put to death whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Idolatry, something worshipped in place of God. That's serious. And oh dear, Paul says we have to do something about it. Put it to death. Choose not to go that way. And Ephesians as well. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or any kind of impurity or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. That's us, by the way, God's holy people. And then the Lord went on to say, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. That is extremely countercultural today. And I fear our Western culture would say to Jesus, surely you've got that wrong, Jesus. That's just what it does consist of. We face an enemy quite unknown to the early church. Advertising. It's designed to make you want stuff, to feel inadequate if you don't have stuff. Commerce wants to sell you stuff with the implied promise it will make you happy. It won't. Advertising is fundamentally designed to make you desire stuff and make you feel good about yourself. In 1 John, we read, everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, come not from the Father, but from the world. The lust of the eyes. I see it, and I want it. Every week, I go walking with a couple of friends. We do about 5 miles. And having done our walk, we stop somewhere, ideally if we can, have a coffee, and we used to have a bit of cake. Then, sadly, one of my friends was diagnosed with diabetes. So we thought, can the two of us who can eat cake sit there eating cake while our friend is sitting there looking at us eating our cake? Not a good idea. Even worse, we might be tempting him to default on his good diet and start eating cake. So we said, right, no cake, just coffee. And we had a good walk last Tuesday, found a nice cafe, ordered our coffees, and myself and the other cake-eating walker looked at the displayed cakes. They really looked magnificent. There was a wide selection. I could have chosen any one of three that particularly appealed to me, and there were others. The lust of the eyes. I see it, I want it. I have to say, that was a serious temptation. It would have been so easy. In fact, the strength of this temptation really quite surprised me. So we have to beware of the lust of the eyes. I mean, let's face it, it may not have been a major sin. I could have told myself if I had a cake. But to decide that a temptation is not a major sin is really not a good idea, because you can extend it to other things. Yeah. Right. The pride of life. A little while back, there was a news report on the television. A celebrity in the West End had been mugged for his wristwatch. It was a Rolex costing £17,000. Now, I could be wrong, but I would suggest you don't spend £17,000 on a watch just to see what the time is. Now, I'm wearing a wristwatch. I was going to say it cost me less than 1% of that 17,000. It cost me less than one half of 1% of that £17,000. And it tells me the time very well. You buy a Rolex for image, for status, to exhibit your success and your wealth, not to tell the time. Oh, other brands of luxury timepieces are available. Incidentally, one of my friends tells me, well, who needs a wristwatch these days anyway? You've always got the time on your mobile phone. Yeah, he is right, but on occasions he has asked me for the time when his mobile phone is buried deep in his pocket. Right, enough of greed. I think we have to go back to the rich fool now and the verdict. This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. Now, I do have a bit of a problem here. Jonathan did the reading and he stopped precisely where he was meant to stop. The trouble is, the Lord didn't. Because if you go on to the next verse, after where Jonathan stopped, it starts, then Jesus says to his disciples, therefore I tell you. So I've got to be careful that I don't start trampling over next week when John will be speaking on the next passage. So, our man, our farmer, is not rich towards God. This implies that in some way he's entering his afterlife, God's presence, empty-handed. Now, if that's correct, the converse must also be true. It must be possible to be rich towards God. Now, we have to be clear. I am not talking about earning salvation. That can never be done. Earlier on, I mentioned the Sermon on the Mount. Luke does not refer to the Sermon on the Mount. But if you had a look in the previous chapter, chapter 11, you will see a whole chunk from the Sermon on the Mount. And if you look at the next verse after our reading, you will see another great big chunk from the Sermon on the Mount. And it's a bit unfortunate for me because today I've had to be largely negative, start churning around all the nasties in life. The break in the text is purely artificial and put there for our convenience in reading. So I'm not going to look at the next few verses. I'm going to jump back to the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be with you as well." I've read that out of Matthew, just so I'm not picking out the verse from the next section, which is verse 31, where you get it's the same wording. Seeking first the kingdom will and must involve concern for others, for not self-centeredness, seeking to go God's way. And that is being rich towards God. Seeking his kingdom is the very opposite of the I want mentality, which desires to possess or desires to impress. So we all have this choice in our lives. Will we go with the I want or continue to seek his kingdom?